It was a huge pleasure to catch up with Joe Pettit for my latest nostalgia interview. Joe works on the same corridor as me at the University of Kent. She's a lecturer in comparative literature. We talk about the art of teaching, the feeling of history that comes from reading a physical book, the nostalgia of children's books. Joe comes from a British working class background in Nottingham against the backdrop of the miners' strikes. She didn't grow up in an academic environment, and she talks about developing a political consciousness at university and how when she goes back, not everything always quite fits. She talks about being a really nostalgic person, but having a terrible memory. We talk about whether it is good to go to another institution after graduating and why some institutions don't always accommodate people from particular socioeconomic backgrounds. We talk about the value of a working class background. We find out about Joe's work in Holocaust studies, what shapes our academic practice, the limitations and the paucity of TV when growing up, Mr. Blobby, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Jojo Rabbit. We learn why it is useful to read a book twice and why Joe lost her love of reading for reading's sake. Now, there are some things not directly learned in the classroom. Maybe you can be more socially aware from going down the pub. We talk about diaries, about Joe's work with children's literature, whether there is a romanticisation of childhood, the necessity of dealing with students who are struggling, and why her aim in her job is to be a safe space. We learn why Jo is quite a positive person, and how during COVID we were channeling nostalgia for the Second World War. Also, the recent death of the Queen has a lot to say about our understanding of nostalgia and the past. And we find out what Jo wanted to do as a child, why a PhD is not a marker of intellectual prowess, and we find out about her peer group and what they are doing now. It was brilliant to catch up with Joe Pettit for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris Deasy. It is my great pleasure to have Joe Pettit this afternoon, because Joe, we are on the same corridor and we have known each other for years and years.
We have.
We're at the University of Kent.
Indeed, I am.
And yeah. Do you want to say what you do here?
I'm a lecturer in comparative literature, and I recently moved onto the corridor, so thank you for having me.
Oh, no, absolutely. Well, I think there was a point where we were passing each other so often, it was like, at some point, you're going to end up on this podcast.
Yes. I eventually got roped in.
Yeah. So as most people on this corridor have at some point. And of course, I remember you as a PhD student in this very university.
Yeah. I mean, that feels like a long time ago, but it also feels like yesterday.
Yeah.
It's a really strange experience to have done my PhD here and then still be here, because also you have this sense of, I guess you have to kind of fight for your place a little bit, don't you? But yeah, I've been here and around for a long time.
Yeah. And I always remember how assiduous you were when, because I used to be senior tutor, I know you do a lot of that sort of thing as well now, but also being completely on the ball, you know, when it came to students and their welfare and everything.
Yeah.
One of those annoying
members of staff who just sees everything and can't let anything slide. I think that's perhaps not the way that I would do things now.
Well, it's interesting, but at the end of the day, I think it's that sort of conscientiousness and say, yes, you know, you take it seriously, and you know that the students see what. And this is the thing that I always find in a job like this, is that the students, you know them at the age of 18, in most cases 21, and then they go away, and then you probably have this as well, some years later you hear back from a student you taught many years ago. And you discover that it's because of their degree and maybe a module with you that it in some way it has sparked an interest. Maybe they become teachers.
Yeah.
And it's like, thanks to what you did X number of years ago, I'm now doing Y.
Yeah.
And you're thinking, I'm glad that I was very attentive to that student, because you can imagine how badly wrong it could go if effectively they're using the education they had with you as a springboard for a career.
Yeah.
Unless, of course, it was all done immaculately. So these things work.
But I mean, I feel very privileged to have the job that I have, partly because of that reason. I feel like you hear back from students all the time. In fact, I got an email this morning from a student who graduated 2 years ago saying, do you want to go for a coffee? And you just don't realise at the time, you're just kind of bimbling around a classroom and talking about books, and it's wonderful, but actually that it helps to shape people in ways that you genuinely don't recognize until, if ever, a long time after the fact. And that's really nice.
I think the nicest thing about this profession is that although obviously there are those students who are doing the modules for credit, and of course they're doing it to get a degree, and that's all laudable and important, but you have those who also say, but it's not just about the degree, it's about the journey there.
Yeah.
And they're part of this journey, and that journey you know, irrespective of how brilliantly they do or otherwise at the end of it, there's something transformative in that learning,
yeah,
that it really matters to them. And I would sometimes say to students, you know, how many of you wake up at 3 a.m. and are pondering, because I was doing a course called Death of God and we were looking at all these big existential questions.
Wow.
And I thought, you know, do these questions really impact you in the way that on paper we're told that everybody is worried about these things? And, you know, most students just like shrug their shoulders and the sort of, well, I don't really know. And then you always get one email say, well, nobody else answered, so I'm emailing you now to say, yeah, I wake up at 3 a.m. and this is really galvanizing me, and I want to make a career and, you know,
wow,
a life out of these sort of questions. So it's not just doing it for credit, it's actually,
yeah,
part of a lifelong education.
Yeah, I think so. And I think I would go even further than that and say that a university education is not just about what you learn in the classroom at all. I was an undergraduate here many years ago, and part of what I considered to be my education was the going and getting drunk in the venue and having time in the cafes and joining the societies and being in the dance shows and all the other things that I did as an undergraduate. I wasn't a perfect undergraduate. In fact, I'm sure many of my lecturers would tell you that I was a pain in the arse for quite a lot of the time. But I didn't read everything, but I did submit my work on time, and I did try and cover the bases, but I wasn't a perfect student, but I learned a lot about who I was in those first few years. And I think that's just as important too, that as academics we can give our students a break and a bit of license to go and explore and figure that out in lots of different ways.
Yeah, and I think that's the difference from school, because that's one of the things that we're really big on telling our students.
Yeah,
my sense at school, there was always the sense that the teachers would tell you what you think is the right answer to the question, maybe strategically,
yeah,
how will I get my best A-level result? Because I listen to what the teacher tells me. And if I remember what they teach me, then I can't go wrong. When you get to university, suddenly, and it can be daunting at first, you see all these books in the library. In the days when it really was a physical looking in the library rather than a Google search type thing. And you go and see all those wonderful books and you think, these people have been writing on these subjects for hundreds, if not thousands of years.
Yeah.
How am I in a position now to suddenly contribute, because I have to write a 2,000-word essay, anything that could possibly make a difference to anything?
Yeah.
And then you realise that you're assimilating stuff that people have written, and you become a mini authority on something within a few weeks.
Yeah.
And then you do another essay and you think, a month ago I'd never heard of this subject. Now I've written 2,000 words with, you know, using lots of very clear jargon and, you know, sort of something that sounds impressive,
yeah,
to me. And I think you're right. And I think that it's saying to students, we are here to guide you and support you, but also we're not here to spoon feed you, because
right,
that is what my experience of school largely was.
Yeah, yeah.
And for me, there was a point where maybe certainly as a second year undergraduate student, everything clicked into place. Sounds like a similar kind of thing for you.
Yeah. And I feel as well, like, especially as students go through their degree and you get to know them a little bit better. You know, I'm from a quite small department, so we get to know our students very, very well. And it becomes a community, and I know that word gets thrown around quite a lot, but I think in the case of small departments, that is genuinely the case. You get to know your students, you help to initiate them into the library life and the reading the book and thinking about what they can contribute. And that's really powerful. I still get it now. I love, one of my favourite things to do, as sad as this is go to the British Library. And I feel like I'm walking into Hogwarts. And you have this such a sense of history. And even the Templeman Library, you go in and you read a book and it has somebody withdrew this 30 years ago. And, you know, this has been in circulation for all those years. And different people have written notes in the margins. And I think it's a really beautiful thing.
And do you find that online reading can you replicate that with an online type of discourse?
I don't think you get the same feeling of history when you're reading a Kindle or an ebook or any kind of library search like that. You know, when you walk into the British Library and you see this great architecture and you see the bookshelves and the reading rooms, there's something really powerful in that. On the other hand, I have a Kindle, I have the Kindle app on my phone, I have the Audible app on my phone, and I regularly read in digital ways, and I think that's part of modern life. But I think it's in some ways a shame and in some ways a necessity and an inevitability.
Yeah, I was finding for a period, because in my office we were just talking before we started recording, that I have all these VHS tapes from the...
which I think are wonderful, by the way.
From the 1990s and earlier. And what's really interesting is that for a long period I was happy to read a book on Kindle on the grounds that you can't destroy a book or ruin the book or crease it to death. But I was still buying hard copy
DVDs or Blu-rays and so on. I'm now sort of into the streaming sort of mindset, although I still go to physical cinemas and you know, the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. And it's very interesting. But some people would say to me, oh, I like the smell of an old book. And I'd be like, I'm happy with Kindle. And yet I was still buying hard copy films. So it's almost as though it's like the same, but just in the different side of the same coin.
Yeah, because interestingly, you don't really have DVDs. I've seen a few, but you mostly have VHS. Is that, did you give up on DVD?
No, they're somewhere else.
Ah, hiding.
But this is where everything goes, where there's no room for it at home.
Right, I see. Okay.
Yes. So what you see here, unfortunately, is not the thing that necessarily represents what I do so much as the overspill. Yes. Yeah, that's right. This is where all the, you don't see all the sort of the day-to-day stuff here.
Yeah.
You just see the overspill.
I'm the same. I have bookshelves at home and I really like having bookshelves at home, and there I keep my slightly, I guess, the easier reading stuff. I have a lot of children's literature, which, funnily enough, is very nostalgic for me, that I read as a kid, and that I would like to have in my house to read to my son, etc., etc. But and then I have my workbooks in my office, and I think it's nice to have them separate, but also for there to be books everywhere. I think that's quite nice.
And I think also that's the nice thing about an office, and actually one of the privileges of working in this profession sometimes, because I can't imagine, you know, if I was working in another sort of industry, should we say, that to have an office, to have my own office anyway, but an office full of my personal artifacts, my own nostalgia, I think, you know, that's a luxury that I frankly can't imagine having in any other walk of life.
Yeah, and it's all stuff that you bought and you wanted, and this is your mini archive, right? And that's quite a nice thing as well.
Yeah. Do you want to say something about how the journey started for you? Because I know from many conversations over the years, about, I think Nottingham is where you're
Nottingham,
from.
Nottingham, yeah.
So in terms of growing up in Nottingham, what are the things that you most remember?
Oh, cool. Drinking John Smith's off the table in the pub on a Sunday afternoon. My dad won't thank me for that, I'm sure. Yeah. I had a really typical British working class upbringing. I grew up round the corner from the old mines. My grandfather was a miner, and we kind of grew up with the mining strikes in the background. I grew up playing with my friends out on the streets in a way that I don't think we really do now, climbing trees, playing in the woods. TV wasn't really a thing back then. Even, you know, I'm not that old, but, you know, TV just wasn't part of your day-to-day existence back then. It's interesting for me because I didn't really grow up in an academic environment at all. I always did all right at school. I was never the best, but I was always reasonable at school. And I did what was expected of me, but I came to university having never really paid much attention to Shakespeare, or I'd never even heard of Goethe, or, you know, some of these really important authors who now I consider an essential part of the canon. Just wasn't part of my upbringing at all. My upbringing was being out playing with my friends and going to the pub on a Sunday afternoon while my dad played cards.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because going to university can be a culture shock.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, I always find it interesting when people go back to their hometowns after university, when, in a way, there's the return to the familiar, but also the sense that you could never get out of your system the fact that you've been doing something for those 3 years. And it can be a luxury. Some people might say, you know, it's almost decadent. You know, you have this chance to do all these things, but it's not part of the real world.
Mm.
Whereas you just highlighted that, of course, it absolutely is.
Yeah.
Because, you know, a world without some of that literature would be a very shallow world indeed.
Yeah.
But for me, I think it was the same as you, of going to university and realising how many blind spots I had, but then almost making it, not necessarily, maybe implicitly rather than something that I set out to do, but almost like trying to fill those.
Yeah.
So that if somebody asked me a question sometimes in the pub, and often I'd get questions like, you're a theologian, tell me about God. And you're like, I'd much rather play cards and have a pint of John Smith, frankly.
Right.
Because those are like, that's such a loaded question. I always joke, and I've said it in this interview, you know, in this podcast many times as well, I can talk to my students about the death of God for 3 hours on a Thursday afternoon.
Mm.
But as soon as I walk into the supermarket and somebody says, what do you teach? And then suddenly when I say religious studies, you just know that you just kind of wish you'd gone to a different operator or gone to the self-service, because suddenly you're opening all sorts of cans of worms.
Yeah.
But for you, I mean, what about the going backness, as it were, to that environment, having had not just a university education, but now to be very much part of the infrastructure as a member of staff.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting for me, because I think the first few times I don't remember going home all that often during my undergraduate degree. But whilst I was here, I think I really developed, and this goes back to what I was saying before, I developed my political consciousness at university. And I had come from being naive of all history, all politics. You know, my dad is vaguely a Tory, but it was never part of my household conversations. And I came to university and all of a sudden was going home with a really strong liberal agenda. And that caused quite a bit of conflict in the house. But it also meant that I had to redefine my friendships. You know, I'd discovered electronic music and the rave scene and, you know, all these other things that I simply had no awareness of at all before I left. Now I'm trying, that's become a really big part of my life. But then you go back to Nottingham and it doesn't quite fit with the relationships that I had before and the home that I had before. And it's taken a long time, actually. Now I still have the friends that I had at school and we're all still, you know, we speak weekly, I would say. And my dad and I have just have a tacit agreement not to talk politics. But it has taken a long time to figure out how my kind of university liberal self fits into that working environment in which I grew up.
And there's something to be said, isn't there, about going away. And I mean, I suppose it's, you know, this is the stuff of mythology. This is Homer, of Dorothy and the Wizard of Oz. but that sense of, you know, leaving your home, leaving your habitat, going somewhere else, having a life-changing experience, and you return home, but you return recharged, renewed, refreshed.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of that juxtaposition of the ordinary and the extraordinary.
Yeah.
Sounds like that's exactly what has happened to you.
I did. I mean, it was a really profound time for me, actually. And I look back on my undergraduate. I should have started this with this quote, actually. I feel like I am a really, really, really nostalgic person, but I also have a really, really, really terrible memory. And those two things don't always work very well together. But I really romanticised my undergraduate years, and I remember them extraordinarily fondly, if I don't remember all of the specifics. And likewise, I really, really romanticised my teen years, but they are two very, very different episodes in my life, and they certainly wouldn't fit together in a very neat way.
I don't think memory is necessarily a part of that, because because that's the thing, because with nostalgia often, I mean, it's interesting that I keep a diary, and so I have a very clear sense of this actually happened, rather than, you know, this is what I'm misremembering because I'm putting my past on a pedestal.
Yeah.
But it's really interesting, isn't it, how sometimes the way that we remember or misremember kind of can be tactical, it can be strategic, because it's our way of coping sometimes, you know, in your case.
Yeah.
And it was the same with mine. My university days, I started living at the age of 18. I've only now been able to start to reconnect and even in some cases interview some of my school friends. But I've always been very ambivalent about school days, because I think that, as we were saying at the start of this interview, going to university meant that I could open those books and suddenly think, ooh, you know, it's not, my teacher's not going to tell me off for misinterpreting this particular line of Shakespeare or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And it was a great period of discovery. And in that sense, I think I did far more in those 3 years at university. I learned so much. And I wonder in some cases if maybe I'm sort of still almost capitalising on those experiences really? All those decades later, because, you know, I learnt the tricks of the trade then, and I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now if it wasn't for that. So those 3 years, it may have been 3 years in linear time, but it's like taken up...
Changed the whole trajectory.
Of my life.
Yeah, and I feel exactly the same, you know, Kent was too far for me to come to university. Yeah. It became my first choice institution, but it was much further away from home than I wanted to be. And one of the consequences was that I very rarely went home during that time. And that might actually have contributed to the fact that I changed so much and so radically very quickly, because I wasn't anchored in a very clear way. But yeah, I agree. I feel like this choice of institution, the choice of course, it was the building blocks that I needed. And, you know, I've never left, really. I left for my master's and then I came back for my PhD and I've been here ever since. So I consider this institution really a part of my fabric.
And because I spent 10 years in the same institution, like you, I did all my degrees actually in the one place, the master's as well as the PhD. But it also meant that when I did finally leave, I couldn't go back for, I think in my case, it was about 16 years.
Wow.
Because it had moulded me so much that I needed the counterpoint.
Right.
And Ken gave me that counterpoint. Mm-hmm. And now I'm very comfortable going back. But I think it took me many years to almost sort of just learn what it was. You know, going to university was a big learning experience. But also in staying there, I kind of think I was taking the better the devil you know path.
Yeah.
But having been away, I can go back refreshed, and I'm involved in lots of alumni type events.
Yeah.
And that's been terrific to do. But I couldn't have done that, you know, 10 or 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah, because you have to figure out who you are outside of that framework and outside of that institution. And I think I kind of got a glimpse of it when I went off to do my MA at an institution that shall remain nameless. But I really did not enjoy my time there. And I think I had a good group of friends, and for that, and I had a very good social time. But academically, I didn't have a good time, partly because I was knocked very quickly off my pedestal. But also partly, I think their ways and systems of working simply didn't correspond with the way that I learn. So I came quickly scurrying back to Kent, which just sits with my personality, I think.
Yeah. And actually, your stories are very familiar, and even people who maybe not now but have been on this very corridor have said the same thing, that they went away, realised that in some cases different institutions may not have been as accommodating or welcoming.
Precisely.
And they said, you know, I'm very happy to go back. And it's actually a step forward to go back to the place where you'd studied before, because you know that it's part of a wholesome journey, rather than one where somebody, you know, might sort of be disdainful to you because of your background or what you chose to study or your particular way of learning. So you sort of learn very quickly what works for you and where you don't fit in.
And I think as well, I mean, the institution where I did my MA is a top institution, and I think my working class roots and what I was saying to you before, that I hadn't grown up reading Shakespeare and Dickens and those gaps in my knowledge became really evident, and they just weren't acceptable. And that might have simply been the level at which I was studying, but also I think it was the level of the institution. And there's a certain lack of patience, I think, that goes into, and a lack of an awareness as well, that not everyone has come from an academic background, you know, long-term academic background. And, you know, I worked more or less full-time all the way through my A-levels, and there's a whole history of why I might have not read quite so much as someone who had been born into slightly more privilege. And I'm not trying to suggest that I had a really hard upbringing, because I didn't at all. I had a wonderful upbringing, but I think that being from a certain socioeconomic background, that there's an expectation of that at certain institutions, I think.
I think you're right. And also in the day, certainly when I was at university, we had grants, and so it didn't matter. Another reason I think why a lot of people travelled so far, and I went to Lampeter, I suppose I didn't travel that far because I was from Cardiff, but there were people from this part of the world, from the southeast, who I actually see often in this sort of part of the world, but they made a very long geographical journey to Lampeter, because in those days you'd get the grant whether you went to the institution a mile down the road or 500 miles away. But the thing that I've noticed is that these days everybody works, everybody has a job, it's normal.
Yeah.
It's unusual for a student not to have a job. In my day, it wasn't. And I look back and realise that because I've only ever worked in the university sector, I went to university at 18 and effectively, you know, that's it. I kind of feel that my students, who in many cases are several decades younger than me, have more life experience in many ways. You look at their CVs sometimes and you think, gosh, they've done various skills in retail, for example. And they've done them at the age of 17 or 18.
Yeah.
And they, you know, there are things that I can probably do now, maybe even quite well, but I certainly couldn't have done that 20 or 30 years ago.
Yeah.
So in many ways, I think that it, you know, it works both ways, but it depends on the vantage point.
Yeah.
You know, from the point of view of the nameless university, all of these things might be a disadvantage. But I think here, in terms of what the university is equipping you for life, just as you were saying, it's not just about going to the lectures, it's about the full round of education. I think it matters a great deal.
I think so, and I agree with you. I am totally proud of my background, and I feel like when I say working class, we weren't poor. You know, we were. It's not like we struggled to put dinner on the table, or not to my knowledge, anyway. And you know, we had a comfortable working life. But I also, I feel like I, there's value in that. It might, you know, I might be slightly less well read than other people. I might have slightly different interests than other people, but I agree with you. I think it's part of who I am and where I've come from.
And often these are things that you don't necessarily appreciate at the time.
Yeah.
It's only when it, many years later that you suddenly realise that the things that you did, maybe obsessively, I mean, for me, and we'll come on to music in a minute, but, you know, writing down the charts on a Sunday, a huge, I mean, laughable almost from today's standards, because why would you do something like that? Because it's all available at the click of a mouse.
But
in those days, you'd be listening to the radio, and if you missed it, you missed it, unless you looked at the pages of CFAX, I suppose, you remember those. And so you'd write everything down. But it's funny, all those decades later, somehow, because I don't just recall writing down the charts on a Sunday, but I remember all the conversations in the playground. I remember my friends. I remember even what I was reading and studying at school at the time, because that might be in the background. So in a funny way, those things that might be seen to be a bit obsessive or a bit maybe, you know, non-obviously academic at the time, certainly now I'm using, because I draw on radio and I draw on film very much as part of my educational work. You know, if somebody said to me 30 years ago, you know, that you one day you'll be in a university and this will be the sort of the resource material, I would have said, that's impossible. So it just goes to show you. So it's almost like future-proofing your own life sometimes.
Yeah, and actually I was asked to partake in a slightly bizarre but really intriguing project recently, where I was asked to write an academic autobiography for part of a collection of how scholars get into Holocaust studies, which is my main field of research. And actually, I found myself reflecting on weekends at my grandparents' house, watching The Sound of Music, and watching Dad's Army with my dad, and all these things that you just don't realise are going to become important, but you're always absorbing the narratives that come out of those. And I think that's, again, it shaped my academic practice, but it's also something I have to be really self-conscious and self-aware of, because I'm coming at that from a very Anglophone English perspective, and that's informing all of the questions that I ask in my research. So again, it works both ways.
Yeah, and one thing I do notice with my own children is just how eclectic things are now, because in those days it was literally, you know, Sunday night, everyone be watching the same, you know, the only choice was whether you watched it on ITV or BBC One in many cases. But the choices were kind of fixed. So we, you know, we'd be having conversations in the school on a Monday about, in those, I can remember That's Life or Mastermind or very, you know, Howard's Way or whatever. And it was like, I didn't necessarily enjoy those programmes, but it was like, well, I'm watching them because they're the only things on.
Yeah.
Looking back now, I think, God, you know, almost what a wasted, you know, there were so many other things I could have been doing.
Yeah.
But also, everyone was doing the same thing.
Right.
And that's so telling.
I think it's partly because of the way TV worked back then. I mean, I remember a Saturday night was, I'm not quite sure of the order, but there was Blind Date, there was Gladiators, and there was Baywatch. And that everybody would watch the three of those on the hop. And it's because you can't, you know, there's no live streaming. That is what's on TV. But Saturday night television was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I think everybody, you know, if you hadn't watched those three things. And I think back then, Coronation Street in Emmerdale, we're also, I mean, certainly in our house, not so much these days, but you know, these are big events in your house, because TV was limited in a way that it's not now.
No, I remember, and I hope my parents don't hear this, but I, this was so funny on a Saturday, because I remember going to university, so this had been early 90s, and on a Saturday, because as you're right, this was, people were still watching those very programs that you just mentioned on ITV, you know, Blind Date. My grandparents would always watch Blind Date.
Bullseye, that was the other one.
It was Jabone. But my parents suddenly got into Noel's House Party, was on BBC. So that was the choice was Cilla on ITV and Noel on BBC
with Mr.
One.
Blobby,
and
right?
Mr. Blobby, which of course made number one in the charts during my university. So as far as the death of Western civilization is concerned, it was probably Christmas 1993. Even my children look at it and think, you know, Daddy, that's weird, you know, that's coming from seven-year-olds.
Oh, how funny. Oh, I hadn't thought about Mr. Blobby in a very long time. Thank you for
I'm
that.
I'm so
moment.
Sorry. Yes. Yeah, well, who knows? Maybe somebody will be doing a dissertation in comparative literature where Mr. Blobby will be the sort of, you know, the counterpoint to an argument. Although I would refuse to supervise them, frankly, if that
would
came
you?
Up.
Would
no,
you?
No, you, I meant. You should.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I should. I'll send them to you.
Oh, I wouldn't. No, send them to me. You know, I get them the first just for the for just, the Schutz bar. But tell me a bit more. Mention music as well. I don't know whether film was a big part of growing up as well.
Mm, No, I wouldn't say massively. We didn't go to the cinema very often. I am told, although I have no memory, that when I was very young, we used to have Jungle Book on a loop. Just it would finish and we'd want it back on. But that was on VHS. And so there were a few Disney films around the edges, I suppose. But beyond that, it was Rodgers and Hammerstein at my grandparents' house at the weekends, which is horribly uncool. And it was horribly uncool then. I don't, you know, but... the consequences, I know more or less all the songs to Sound of Music, more or less by heart, which, you know, I'm in my mid-30s. I feel like I probably shouldn't know that. And South Pacific, you know, they're just a strange accumulation of very old films. But I wouldn't say it was a part of my everyday, certainly as I grew up.
I actually only saw Sound of Music, at least in full, for the first time at the BFI in, I think, 2018.
Wow.
It's the sort of film I feel I've known. You know, I was like, of course I know the Sound of Music, but and same with Mary Poppins. I don't think I'd ever watched it in its entirety because it was always on. Because it was always on, it was like, oh, I'll catch it next bank holiday or whatever. And I don't think I've ever seen South Pacific, which is really interesting.
Right.
So I've got all these sort of film blind spots. But interesting that you grew up with those. So that was obviously big in a grandparents type context.
Yeah, I think so. Mm. We'd go to my grandparents the weekends while my dad was at the football. This, I mean, I'm talking when I'm you know, 6, 7, 8 sort of age. And they would have a selection of VHS films that we could choose. And we would always... Sound of Music was really regular. South Pacific, less so. And occasionally we would have, you know, I don't know when I first saw Mary Poppins, but I was certainly, I had seen it and I have seen it many times. So that's obviously been in the periphery as well. It's not that I didn't see any films. It's just that we say, and I do this now, the same thing over and over again. If I want to watch a film to unwind at the end of the day, I'll put on something I've seen a million times before. And it just so that I can almost just zone out from it. I don't know why I do that, because it means I miss out on an awful lot of things.
Oh, I disagree. Yeah, no, I agree with you. I disagree with the concern, because I'm the same as you, that sometimes it's if something is like we all have a go-to something or other. It's like, I mean, music is a good example. If a piece of music really means something to you, you're not going to say, well, I've heard it once, I'm not going to listen to it again. You listen to it repeatedly. And I think it can be, I mean, I don't read novels. I suppose novels take me a long time to read compared to a film. But often I'll go back to them, watch the same film at the cinema, and because I write my reviews and so on. But often I do get more, I mean, the film Jojo Rabbit, I've mentioned this in the podcast many times, I saw it once in Dover with there seemed to be lots of teenagers, and they were. And I don't know if it's a film that you're familiar with, but certainly
I'm actually teaching it in a few weeks, but haven't seen it yet.
No.
Don't tell anyone.
No. But the funny thing about that, because obviously the Holocaust plays a big part in that, and there's humour, so it's sort of it's set in the time of the Holocaust, but there were people laughing at the jokes, and I found it very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I despised the film for that reason. Then it got all these Oscar nominations, and I thought, well, you know, am I missing something? And somebody said, I think you should watch it again. So I watched it at the Curzon in Canterbury, and actually another lecturer happened to come in with his family. They sat next to me. So it was a completely different experience, and I really appreciated it. So that's an example of why watching the same film more than once can be very useful. But it's those go-to things from, in my case, university, that, you know, I know I'll get something out of them. And it's a way of touching base with yourself, but also when there's a lot of chaos in the world sometimes, to watch, you know, Romy and Michelle's high school reunion or The Fugitive or whatever it might be.
Yeah.
Sometimes there are those films that I watch and they sort of almost allow me to press that reset button.
Yeah.
And recalibrate, and I can, you know, begin the next day with all the traumas and the chaos that life brings.
Yeah. Jojo Rabbit's an interesting one, actually. I mean, I've seen lots of clips of it where people have presented on it, but it's part of a long history of using comedy in relation to the Holocaust, and I think that's important too. But just the practice of seeing things, for me, is just a way of relaxing, because if you haven't seen a film before and you only have a loose idea of what it's about, you actually have to concentrate. Whereas if it's something, I guess it is a nostalgia, it's something that I feel very comfortable with if I've seen it before and I know what's going to happen, and so consequently I do tend to repeat.
Yeah. And but also in a teaching context, sometimes that can be very important, because you're trying to explain to students, for example, why something matters. And as part of that process, of course, you know, you're engaging with the materials yourself and maybe revisiting some of those.
Yeah.
And maybe getting things out of the films that you wouldn't have first time round. I mean, in my case, it's only when I was doing my reviews, I think during lockdown, and I rewatched all of these films from the 90s that I'd watched at university, and suddenly it occurred to me that so many of these big films were all white, middle-aged men, middle-class men, with their midlife crises. Mm. You think of all the, you know, Michael Douglas in Basic Instinct, or you think of Clint Eastwood in The Line of Fire, Harrison Ford, The Fugitive, Bill Murray, Groundhog Day, or whatever. They're great films, but almost like they wouldn't be made now.
Right.
They're very, there's something very, it's all, you know, it's, there's a very niche element to them. But at the time, we just took it for granted. It's only now, I think I'd watched Nomadland not, you know, a year or two ago, and maybe I'd watched one of these 90s films around that time, and I suddenly realised that those 90s films almost, it felt, even as I was reviewing them, there was almost like a certain indulgence to them, because they somehow, I felt uncomfortable almost revisiting those, when it just felt that they were part of a culture and a time where a lot of the, perhaps, you know, they wouldn't get away with making those sort of films today.
Yeah.
So I have to, my reviews would have to reflect that, rather than say, yeah, brilliant films. They might be a brilliant film at the time, and I will always go back to them, but I'm just aware that film has to evolve, just as I have to evolve.
But also, I mean, that's useful, isn't it? Just looking back. And again, you can you can identify much more readily after the event what's been happening for the last decade or two. I always say to my students that it's useful to read a book twice, especially if you're going to write your essay on it, because, and I, this goes back to my terrible memory, read, every time I teach a book, I reread it. Not quite every time, but most of the time, because I have an awful memory, and because I, the importance is in the detail. And I think you can only really get that and reinterpret that when you've, first of all, it's fresh in your mind, but second of all, that you become so familiar with something that you're very comfortable bouncing different ideas off the ball. And I think that it certainly helps my teaching, and I hope it helps my students. I'm sure not all of them read a book twice, even if I tell them to. But I do think that there is a lot to gain in that second reading, like you were saying before.
Yeah, but do you find that, I mean, there's always the expression, the reading for pleasure, that, you know, it's like, well, all reading is for pleasure, or potentially not. But do you find, I mean, are you equally reading lots of new things?
No.
Maybe for your own gratitude. You've answered the question for me, as opposed to going back over those classics. What's the interplay for you?
So I, if I'm completely honest, I somewhere along the way lost my love of reading for reading's sake. And I think that is an inevitability when you read for a job. And I love what I do, and I love reading the stuff that I teach, and it's why, part of the reason I really like launching new modules, because it forces me to read stuff that I wouldn't have otherwise read. But the last thing I want to do when I go home at the end of the night is open a book, because I spend all day, and in fact I spend a lot of my own time reading as well, in order to prepare for lectures, seminars, or for research purposes. So I read an awful lot. I don't know how many books a week I read, but I read a lot of novels and critical works, etc., etc. So when I go home at night, do I want to pick up a novel? No. So that's a shame, I think, because the reason I got into literature in the first place is because I like reading. But at the same time, I feel very privileged that I get to do this for a job. So the fact that I don't read a huge amount of the contemporary stuff is simply because it doesn't have as much bearing on my teaching practice, I don't feel too.
Although you did also talk about a number of books that you'll read in a week, whereas because obviously I work in a different area, I don't have the luxury, but you know, the time is what I mean to read novels. So I'll read a novel and I'll read every single word, you know. So I don't, it was obviously for academic stuff sometimes. You obviously, if you're working on a project, of course, you're not going to read every single word in every single book, because you'd never get very far. You have to also find strategically the right bits. You know, this chapter's good, but this one I can, you know, it's fine to gloss over a chapter. But if I'm reading a novel, once I'm committed to it, I will. I think Moby Dick is one exception. I got about two-thirds in and thought, no, I cannot get on with this. You know, I thought, all these epigrams and so on. But what's really interesting is that when I'm reading a novel, I'll take time, and take me weeks, in some cases maybe months, I don't know, to read, to do it properly, because I'm fitting around everything else. But I find that the cinema thing is interesting for me, because it is a good counterpoint to what I do by day. Because I'm going at the end of a day at work into an environment of potentially lots of other people, but it's a different space and it's a different experience. And I do my reviews and I come back to work. But it kind of feels it's sufficiently different for me not to feel it's just a continuation of the day job, even though I probably end up making it part of the day job by the way that I, in terms of what I teach and so on.
Yeah.
But there's very much a sense of, I'm not doing this on campus, otherwise I be at the Gulbenkian every night.
Yeah.
So it's very much a different sort of space around a different group of people who've got nothing to do with the university environment.
Yeah.
So I think actually, so it's not what you've just said though, it's probably not surprising, because otherwise you'd just be doing nothing but reading.
Exactly.
And sometimes you'd probably feel that you're almost having to discriminate between the reading that you're doing as part of your teaching and your research and anything else you want to do. And that doesn't sound like a very fair balance to have to strike.
I mean, I don't watch much TV. I might have half an hour before I go to bed with the screen on, but I think partly because I spend a lot of time in front of the screen anyway.
Yeah.
So what I would like to do with my days off is go out and leave the house and be outside and go for a walk or so, you know, these other cultural things that I would love to do, like spending time in the cinema. And there's been a number of films that I would have loved to have seen. I'm a bit of a Top Gun nut, so I would have loved to have seen the new Top Gun, but I didn't even make it that far to the cinema just because, I mean, first of all, logistically, it's very complicated. But second of all, there are other things that I would like to do with my time when I am not in my office.
Yeah. But also, and maybe it's just worth spending a bit of time talking about your experience of being at university itself, because I do think that can be the template, as we were saying earlier, for so much of what you go on to do, not just professionally, but in terms of, you know, who you are as a person, because it's... The difference from school is that at school, you know, if you don't do the thing, you get told off, or there is a spoon-feeding element. But suddenly at university, it's how you seize that opportunity that you can choose to do no work at all, although you'll come a cropper if that's the case. Or alternatively, you can just savour every moment, but also have the most amazing, and the two are not irreconcilable, the most amazing social life.
Right.
And I think back to those conversations that I had with people that I was at university with, and whether they know it or not, although I've met up with many of them in recent years and they know this, but they influenced me. Maybe those conversations down the pub 30 years ago, random conversations in some cases, somebody will say something that has taught me an invaluable lesson, or it was a bit of advice that I've taken on board and it's still applicable today. So I think that it's the whole tapestry of things. And you don't know in many cases until many years or even decades later just how invaluable those, and it is those random occasions.
Yeah.
And going out for a social drink can tell you much more about the state of the world than what you read in a book.
Yeah.
Or what's on the news, or indeed what you get from a lecture.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't become politically aware because of stuff that I learned in lecture. Although that's, you know, I think probably the starting point was maybe reading about, you know, reading 7 years in Tibet or something, and really starting to think about what was happening between China and Tibet. And maybe that sparked something more political in me. But certainly the evolution of becoming this sort of super left-wing hippie type that happened when I was at, when I was an undergraduate, that wasn't something learned in a classroom. That was something that came through my social interactions, through the people I was mixing with. And again, it didn't always fit neatly with the people I knew in Nottingham.
Mm.
But I think that is part of the social fabric of the university, and my university experience, certainly. So politically, I became much more aware at the pub, that or just out with my friends than I did in a classroom.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, and I wish, one of my regrets is that I didn't write down as much about those things, those ordinary encounters, which often are very far from ordinary, because they're the transformative things that, you know, when we look back on our lives, often it's not what you learn in the lecture theatre, although often it can be, but what those conversations down the pub afterwards. I always would take copious notes from my lectures, but through the diary, I do have a record of the things that went on outside of that. And for me, that is the really precious thing.
Mm.
And that's the real thing. And also that's the bespoke thing, bespoke to me.
Yeah.
Because the lecture material, you could argue, is common to lots of people, and it's stuff that you can get from books and so on. But this is like my own lived history that perhaps not many other people are privy to. Do you accord any sort of importance to that kind of discourse?
Yeah. I mean, I'm in many ways envious of the fact that you have your own personal archive. I started to write a diary when I was a lot younger, and I think I did it for a week, and I started to do it before I go to bed, and then, you know, it would get shorter and shorter and then dissipate. And actually, it would be really nice to look back on how I thought about certain events and how I interpreted them and what happened that particular day. I mean, it's a wonderful resource and archive that you have of your own life that you couldn't get from any. And like I said, I have a terrible memory. So I know that I had a wonderful time at school, and I have some wonderful memories of causing chaos with my teachers, stories that my school friends will no doubt tell many times. But there is, you know, the specifics of what actually happened and who I spoke to and who I felt close to at a particular point or what I learned in a particular day, all of that is more or less lost. And because my memory is terrible anyway, it's something I lament, actually.
It's interesting because I used to keep a diary in like the half-term holidays. It would almost be like, oh, I'm not in school this week. I'll write a diary. But the diary would consist of all the, and it's absurd, really, you know, this is what I wrote on, watched on television or something. I'm like, right. But what about the stuff that happened in the school? You know, it's almost as though I had this amazing sort of resource, but it was misdirected. Obviously, there is lots on the school days. Mm. But now I realise, you know, I could never stop writing the diary. But it's almost like, it's not like at the time I thought, hey, this might be an archive for the historians of the future. Of course, I wasn't thinking that. I mean, that'd be ludicrous. And that's only because I've suddenly realised just how big a part this plays in my life. Mm. And other people have often said to me, you know, not that they've read it, but they know that, you know, you're potentially sitting on a gold mine in terms of all the things that have happened. And the things that might seem to be random that you mentioned in the diary, and then suddenly 3 or 4 years later, then it takes on a completely new significance based on absolutely. What's happened. So that is important. But also it can be a good corrective against false memories or... we all do it. We eulogise the past or we put people on pedestals or we might demonise them.
Yeah.
And actually the diary can often tell you that on a particular day, actually you didn't think something was as great as you imagine now that you must have done at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I've been teaching a lot of... This is a slightly different kettle of fish, but I've been teaching a course on children's literature, and there is this idea there that there is the hidden adult in all children's literature, right? That the adult author is already going through this process of idealising and romanticising childhood. And we had this idea that, you know, when you're young and you, I mean, probably younger than, I don't know when you started your diary, but you're free and you're innocent and you have this association with nature and the outside world. But actually, I have no corrective against that. You know, that's quite possibly a misconception. You know, was that really what it was like? Did it feel like that at the time of 7 or 8? And I'm not sure that it would have felt like that at the time. But we look back at it and as adults and think that was the perfect time and it was the most joyful and the freest and the most innocent. But, you know, on the ground when you experience it, I'm not sure it's quite that straightforward.
No. And also, of course, because of hindsight, it's easy now to look back on those days and think, you know, I mean, we didn't have mobile phones in those days and that may be good or not good. But there were things that in those days we just took for granted because that was the world in 1982 when I started the diary. So that there's all these sort of things that I've got from that era. But actually, even from university, what I remember, I could say, yeah, it was wonderfully successful. I did brilliantly and I did all these things. But also, I was stressed. I didn't know what the future had in store. Even sometimes you think, oh, my accommodation has fallen through for next year. It's the end of the world. But, you know, but there was always something. You know, I might go out of an evening with my friends and have a super night having my John... We always had £1 pint of John Smith's. That was a wonderful thing to do. Not for a pound. in the early 90s. You know, wonderful memories. But at the same time, you know, I'd be out. But what would we be talking about 3/4 of the time the next essay or that we were worried about our exams or whatever it might be?
Yeah.
So wonderful memories. But because things worked out in the end, then somehow you gloss over some of those.
Yeah.
But if things hadn't gone so well, I'd have a very different take, I'm sure, on that era.
Yeah. And you say with students now, I think it's very easy for us from our ostensibly comfortable academic perspective where we've quote-unquote made it in the world and we have relatively secure careers, etc. Yeah. And you see a student come in who's really struggling and grappling with pressures of academia and timelines and maybe mental health concerns, and it's very, very easy to just, you know, especially if you're British, to say pull your bootstraps up, you know, get on with it, and you know, I did it, it's not that difficult. But actually, I think if I'm honest and I really reflect back on those time, I think we all had some seed of that somewhere, and I think a sympathetic approach and just some kind of understanding. Otherwise, we lose that connection with the students who are struggling because we have this, oh, it was all so wonderful, how can you possibly be struggling attitude? And that's not always helpful.
And I know some people who will, you know, today think, oh, you know, students, they can be very annoying or whatever. But actually, you know, we were all students once. And everybody, even those people who perhaps, you know, take that line, will probably remember a tutor who saw potential in them
right.
and said, okay, I'm going to support you and I'm going to make sure that you have the chance to cultivate that career, etc. And I think that's something that I always remember, that students might be struggling or they might, you know, sometimes come to you in tears, as they often do, and something's not right.
Mm.
But, you realise that that was me 30 years ago.
Yeah.
Or in those days, there may not have been a senior tutor type person to go to.
Right.
And nobody to break down in tears with.
Exactly.
And I think that is something that is always a corrective, no matter how... You know, we always have different, you know, who are we working for? We're working for the university, or we have, you know, we have an employer. But the students are also, like, on a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, of course.
They matter more than anything.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, if somebody comes to you in tears, you have to deal with that.
Yeah,
and that might not be what's, you know, officially in the contract, as it were.
Right, yeah. And I think that's my aim in my job is to be a safe space, right? A safe space in the classroom and a safe space in my office. And if a student needs me, even if it's just for the sake of a coffee and event, you know, I'm not a qualified counsellor, but I'm a human being and I'm happy to try and connect on that level. And I think, I don't know, but I think that's something that's started to change over time. I feel like even when I was an undergraduate, you didn't have that sort of connection. There was still that sort of professional distance with your lecturers. And I think that should be there to a certain extent. You know, there are boundaries that need to be in place, but at the same time, those boundaries need to be enforced in such a way that you are still someone who can connect with on a human level, because otherwise you're never going to create that safe space.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a balancing act.
Yeah. And would you say, just thinking, as you look back on your life and career, I mean, are your memories positive ones on the whole?
Yeah. I would say I'm quite a positive person. And this, you know, I said before, I'm a really nostalgic person, but I have really fond memories of my teenage years, my childhood, certainly my early academic career. You know, I look back on my early academic career in a slightly pained way, that I was, you know, the way that I came across in seminars was perhaps not the way I would come across now. But I think I'm mostly a very optimistic person. And
that's interesting, because do you find that when you're teaching your students now, do you see your younger self in them?
Yeah.
Because I don't know.
Mostly the annoying ones.
but that's interesting. So do you kind of feel... You know, do you look back on? I have no idea what obviously you're referring to. I was just saying that in a classroom context, you were.
I was gobby. I was really loud, and I dominated the conversation. And there was, I feel like I had this air of arrogance about me that was totally misplaced. And it's, I guess it was my time at another institution that really made me realise quite how misplaced it was, and that I had to go back to the drawing board and reconsider what I think I know and what I need to learn and how to be a you know, functioning academic somehow. I'm certainly not proud for the way I conduct myself.
but do you find, though, that when you became a teacher yourself, when you started lecturing, was that an easy transition, or did you have to suddenly like rethink your whole modus operandi?
I don't think I've ever been somebody who has struggled to stand up in front of a room. So I think in that sense, it was fine. I think what I've learned along the way is that I don't know most. I don't know some of the answers. I don't know most of the answers. And I think I really enjoy the conversational aspect of seminars and teaching, so that I can tell you some things from some books about X subject, but actually the students are also bringing a huge amount to that conversation, and that's something that I really enjoy, and it's something that I think I have developed and learned as I've gone along.
Yeah, that sense of learning from the students. So the educator is itself, you know, is him or herself no less susceptible to learning rather than this is the way it is.
Yeah, and I think that for me was a really valuable lesson, because it takes confidence to accept that and to enact that in the classroom. If you're really insecure and you're or you don't have that confidence in your teaching ability, then it's very easy to take quite a dictatorial line and this is the thing I'm teaching today, and I've got my lesson plan that is minuted to the second. And actually I don't go in that direction anymore. I barely have a plan when I walk into the classroom. I have some topics I would like to cover. And I think that for me has always been a much more productive way. But it's something, you know, when I first started teaching, I had these second by second lesson plans. I'm sure everyone does. They overthink it. They over prepare. They create numerous activities and they try and reinvent the wheel. But actually, I think just having a conversation about important topics of a book is, for me, the most valuable way.
And you're right. It's often what you do in that space. And it's the unanticipated, because I've often walked into a room and should I be admitting this? You know, sometimes at 9 a.m, certainly, you know, when we had to record our lectures during lockdown. So I'd be recording the lectures, but often doing them a few weeks in advance.
Yeah.
And then do the seminar. But by the time of the seminar, I'd already done one, maybe in some cases, more than one lecture ahead. So I was sometimes forgetting exactly how far I'd got with those students, because I'm like two lectures ahead.
Right.
And I sometimes say, as I was saying in the lecture, oh, no, that's next week's lecture. And it was very interesting. So sometimes I really needed the students to anchor me, to steer me, because otherwise I was potentially going to sort of go off in all directions. And sometimes I was sometimes doing two lectures back to back on different year groups. And I'd sometimes just genuinely almost like walk in, just think, hold on, I've got to remember now which one this is.
Yeah.
Because I've got the online classes, I've got the physical classes, I'm doing, you know, two consecutive classes. And so in many cases, I needed the students almost to lead the discussion, just to ensure that I was with them and not going off in a direction that actually left them behind. Because that would be the worst teacher, having a class for 2 hours when there's just a collapse in the sort of, you know, the culture of expectation.
Yeah, I agree. And isn't it funny how COVID changed those things, that we had to all change our practice in really considerable ways. And I think some for the better and some for the worse. And I think now we are purportedly coming out of the back end of the whole scenario. It's interesting to see how our practices have changed long term.
Yeah. And actually, there's a question I always ask in this context is, you know, whether negative experiences can have a bearing on the way we think about things and, you know, the way we apprehend the past, I suppose, whether we think nostalgically, that sometimes it's not just a case of thinking, oh, the past was wonderful, I wish I was there again. In many cases, it can tell you as much about the present as it does about then.
Yeah.
And I suppose sometimes negative experiences can be helpful in terms of making us think, okay, let me recalibrate, let me work out what my destiny is, you know, and often it's the bad things on the way, how we learn from them that can change us. Have you had those sort of experiences?
I think so, yeah. And actually, I've mentioned to you before, I've recently edited a book on memories of the Second World War during the COVID pandemic. And so to me, it seems, and not just to me, I don't think, but there has been this we've always been nostalgic about the Second World War, right? But that during COVID, we really drew on that nostalgic memory as a means of fighting back against this thing that couldn't really be fought. And we have Boris Johnson, who, you know, the admirer and biographer of Churchill, who was really trying to channel Churchillian rhetoric in a way that, in my view, didn't entirely work or work at all. But there is this whole host of stuff that happened around the pandemic that was all rooted in nostalgia. And it was nostalgia for the past, but almost a weird situation where we were romanticising the war as a beautiful time in England. And it was a really strange experience to watch that unfold in real time, where people were genuinely looking back on the war as the time of British superiority. It was a really strange
I agree with you, and it's similar to what we were saying earlier about how you look back on those events from the past, and because things worked out all right on the night, as it were, then actually that changes the way you look at it, because it's easy to say now, oh well, the Second World War was a great success, well look, yeah, okay, there were lots of casualties along the way, but we won the war. But the way that Boris Johnson, even when he came out of hospital during the early days of COVID, actually said in Downing Street, you know, let's treat the virus as a, you know, it's like a war, that's the enemy, and we're you know, halfway there, we're going to trounce the enemy, we're not quite there yet, but the enemy will be vanquished, don't worry. He was using, you know, the fighting spirit.
It was the rhetoric of war, all
fascinating
of it.
That actually using a virus then in almost in that sort of militaristic terms,
yeah,
which is, you, and of course that was also around the time that Vera Lynn died.
Yeah.
And when the Queen recently died, it was the same dynamic. People then remembering, because she obviously was around in the Second World War, mm-hmm. but very much, you know, channeling that wartime spirit, romanticising warfare.
And Catherine Jenkins, the Welsh opera singer, she filmed this intriguing thing of her singing We'll Meet Again that was superimposed over Vera Lynn. So in effect, after Vera Lynn had died, they were doing a duet. And so that was really encapsulating all of that. And you're right, the monarchy is another symbol of this nostalgic past, I think, and which bizarrely covers up a huge imperial history. But we romanticise and we... especially with the Queen, I would say more so than with Charles, we have this idea of her as this icon, this ideal icon, who was seen as out of the back of empire and something that, you know, Britain should be really proud of. Now, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be proud of the royal family, and I'm not going to be drawn on a debate about that, but it is interesting to me the way that we anchor our identity in these kind of figures. And the Queen's death happened at a time when society was collapsing, the economy was collapsing, you know, everything was going wrong in government. And it's almost like the Queen dying was a bit of a gift to the Tories because it disguised and gave them a couple of weeks at least to focus on that instead of what was really happening.
Yeah. I mean, do you think, when you were that younger person, drinking the John Smiths or watching your dad playing cards or whatever, could you have imagined where you'd be now? Could you imagine that you'd be doing what you're doing now in your life?
No, absolutely not.
What do you think you would have thought?
Well, when I was at primary school, I wanted to be a primary school teacher. And when I was at secondary school, I wanted to be a secondary school teacher. And then when I came to university, I went, that's what I want to do. And so I was quite lucky in always having some kind of trajectory. I think if I wasn't doing what I was doing now, I would probably teach. But I have taught at that level before to under 18s, and I found it very, very difficult because you are teaching people who don't really want to be there. And in some sense, you're therefore just babysitting rather than actually doing anything. Not all in all cases, but you can't always have the rewarding experiences that the adverts would have you believe, right? So I was very lucky that I always had a trajectory, whether or not anyone thought I would end up with a PhD. This is my dad's not going to thank me for this story. I once said to him when I was, how old would I have been, 11, something like that. We were in his car and he said to me, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I'd like to be an astronaut. And he said, he looked me square in the face. He said, Joanne, to be an astronaut, you need to be two things. You need to be very, very fit and very, very clever. And you, dear, are neither. So, I mean, very... not very supportive. I have him about this all the time, but very much in his sense of humour, I think. He would have supported me, I'm sure, had I gone in that direction. But he was right. I am not very fit and I am not particularly clever, so I would never have made it for NASA. But I think that's the kind of...
I love the way you say you're not particularly clever, but now you're in a university department and you write books.
I don't think any other academic is going to thank me for saying this, but I fundamentally believe that I did not get a PhD because I'm clever. Yeah. I think a PhD is not about intellectual intelligence. I think it's much more determination and grit and just sticking at it.
Oh, I agree. Yeah, because otherwise, I mean, you know, I look in awe. You know, remember the guy who won Mastermind and it was a big thing was made... I think he was a London cab driver.
Right.
And it's like, oh, London cab driver, wins Mastermind. And he knows everything, you know. He has that sort of mind. And I think, I watch things like Mastermind and think, I really don't know the answers to these.
No.
I look at my own children's homework. We were talking about this before we started recording and think, you know, writing Anglo-Saxon verse. And I'm thinking, they're 7 years of age. You know, why can't I help them? Or why do I feel inadequate in that? But I think, it's that commitment and dedication that actually works. It's not about being very, very clever, but it means that you're dedicated and you're committed and you see something through to the end. But for many clever people, writing, you know, PhD is writing 100,000 words in 3 years. That's just not going to work for some people. It doesn't mean they're not intelligent.
Right,
it's not an intelligence test.
No.
That's why I always find that when my eldest has just sat the Kent test, you know, the grammar school test, and it's all this non-verbal reasoning, but it's kind of like an exercise in knowing, you know, in cleverness, really. But that's very different from the sort of, you know, what I think is the foundation of of education, where it's not so much the cleverness in you know, doing this sum and trying to work out the answer through complicated puzzles.
Yeah.
But actually, it's actually doing the research, going to the library or wherever, going to the British Library.
Yeah.
And undertaking and being, you know, caught up in the atmosphere and sticking with it and not giving up.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting insight. But when you go back, well, not necessarily physically go back, but assuming you're in touch with, say, school friends, as mm-hmm. you know now, what's your relationship with them like? Do you find that there are sort of differences in terms of maybe expectation, in terms of the path that you followed and the path that they followed?
My school group of friends is a particularly interesting case study. So we were five. One now works in retail. One had children very, very young. And she was, I'm sure she won't mind me saying, she was at the time living in social housing. She had her first child. She was living on her own. And in her own time, she did an accountancy course and became a bookkeeper and now owns her own home. And, you know, she's done extraordinarily well from a backdrop of something you would perhaps not expect to be a good start. We have in the group of five, two PhDs, strangely, but we were the only two to go to university at all. So both of the university people kind of followed.
Went all the way.
We're a really, really mixed group when it comes to that. And yet when we get back together, it's like no time has passed at all. Yeah. And I think we spend a lot of time reminiscing about our various adventures at school and the chaos that we used to cause. And, you know, we now all have children of similar ages, and, you know, so it's there's a lot of things that hold us together, but not our academic or career paths necessarily.
Yeah. And that also shows that in, you know, we all, I mean, even what we do, because there are plenty of people in this university, even on the same corridor, I don't necessarily know what they're researching or what they're doing.
Yeah.
But the things that we have in common are often not down to the specifics of the fact that we all study the same sort of philosophy or literature or theology or whatever it might be. There's a lot more that can bind us together.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And history, just a shared history. I mean, we've been friends for 25 years, you know, so it's, there's a whole lot of stories that come as part of that history, and there's a comfortableness that comes with that as well.
Yeah. And my very last question, Jo, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I'm both, and that's a horribly annoying answer. I know. I'm really nostalgic. I do spend a lot of time reminiscing about the past and thinking about how wonderful, you know, certain chapters of my life were. But I'm also super organized, and I like to plan and think about where I think less so now that I have Sproglet and I have, you know, the things that you're supposed to have as a grown up, you know, so I perhaps spend less time worrying about it than I used to. But I think for the time being, I like to see where I'm going to be in 10 years, but I also, because my boy is so young, I also spend a lot of time chilling in the present. So that's a very unhelpful answer, that I'm all three, past, present and future, depending on my the time of day.
Well, you just brought in the entire space-time continuum.
I know.
So, Jo, it has been wonderful to catch up with you for this interview. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.